Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City. Yep. We have no emails to release here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're totally transparent. You better believe me. Happy to have you here listening to the show. If you're listening on 990 AM WGSO in New Orleans here on Thursday, thanks very much. If you are listening down the road, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, whenever, weeks from now on the podcast, I also really appreciate it. Thank you very much for tuning into the show, however you listen and wherever you may be. If you're interested in the podcast, of course, friends, you can go to noladrinks.com. And we're on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn Radio, now on Stitcher. We're streaming on TuneIn as far as the streaming portion goes. And yeah, you can find all that information on noladrinks.com. Go check it out. Folks, as you may know, Tales of the Cocktail, which is basically the spirits industry's largest professional trade event, my understanding anyway, it makes its annual trek here to New Orleans. Always happens here every year around the third week of July, and then there's always an event that takes place. I think it goes for 2 year blocks. They call it Tales on Tour, where it's in a different country. But we always have it here once a year in July. And it's a great opportunity for people to get together in the spirits industry, bartenders, spirits producers, all kinds of stuff. So we're going to talk about that at the very end of the show. Some things going on with Tales of the Cocktail, our coverage, what we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing a ton of stuff. We're going to be all over it next week. But we are in the throes of preparation for Tales of the Cocktail, as it were, here on the NOLA Drink Show. So what we're doing today here on the show is I've pulled a couple interviews from the not-so-distant past that have some relevance to, I think, things at Tales, some more to, you know, certain degrees than others. The first interview that we're going to run goes back to January 5th of this year, and we interviewed Nathan Dalton, who was the food and beverage director at the Catahoula Hotel, which has a Pisco-driven bar, and they feature Peruvian food. So you see how I'm going with this. We're going to talk about Pisco, and then also we actually recorded this down in Houma at the home of Matthew Noel, and Matthew is one of the two filmmakers who made the wonderful documentary Pisco Punch, A Cocktail Comeback Story. It's a really, really great documentary about, it was meant to be about Pisco, it was meant to be a short film, and then it became something much more. You'll hear all about that in the interview. This is sort of an in case you missed it kind of thing. I really want to make sure that people hear this. Supposedly the plan, it premiered at the Napa Valley Film Festival in the fall of last year. We actually were fortunate enough to have a private screening at Matthew's house on January 5th, and we went down and recorded that portion of the show. It's a beautiful film, and supposedly it, I think the plan still is for it to see the light of day on iTunes and perhaps some other services a bit later this year. But a very important story, a very important film, not just about Pisco, but also about really the history of Peru, its political landscape, and using really Pisco to kind of tell a much larger story. And the reason why I wanted to play that here today is, one, because I wanted you to hear it. I think it's important. And two, you know, Pisco is one of those beverages that's, you know, more or less on the uptick here around the country, becoming very popular. I know it's very popular in New Orleans and elsewhere in the bar community with bartenders, those in the service industry. It's a wonderful beverage. And I think we're going to be talking about Pisco most likely during Tales of the Cocktail, directly or if not at least indirectly. And Pisco will be enjoying a pretty big presence, from my understanding, at the event. So it seemed a little bit relevant there. And then what we're going to do, we pulled a little bit of an interview from September, April. And we chatted with, specifically April 27th. And that was when we were covering the Southern Regional Meeting of the United States Bartenders Guild, which took place in New Orleans this year. They moved that around the southern region. We had it this year here in town. And that's where folks from the United States Bartenders Guild, USBG, from the region get together and talk shop for 2 or 3 days. And we had a basically unprecedented access to that, which I really appreciate. Thanks to Mark Shetler and the rest of the gang here at the New Orleans chapter of the USBG. And we basically covered the whole event. We talked about lots of things. We were basically able to sit in on anything that we wanted to do, which we did. and fascinating, some workshops and seminars and fun events and all kinds of cool stuff. But one of the most important things, and something that's been a significant issue in the hospitality industry, particularly in the bartending industry, the spirits industry, and really our world in general, has been sexual violence, and sexual violence in bars and in the industry. It's a big problem, and it was kind of being swept under the rug quite a bit. I think people sort of thought, hey, the bar is this place where, you know, boys will be boys kind of mentality, if you will, and some of these things. And people are really making a stand on this. There are resources out there to prevent this, programs out there to provide education on sexual violence in bars, people trying to create safe spaces, mechanisms, these sorts of things in these places to ensure not only patrons, but also members of the industry are also safe from this. Again, raising awareness. And we interviewed Felicia and Scott Mayer. Felicia is a counselor who specializes in sexual violence, and Scott Mayer, her husband, is the director of brand advocacy and education for Fratelli Branca. Those are the folks that make Fernet Branca, of course, and that sort of thing. And they also have the Carpino Antica line of vermouth and different things like that. And they're big into the issue. They've been doing a presentation. They worked with our good friend Mark Scheller, whom I just mentioned, of the United States Bartenders Guild. But he is working with another good friend of the show, Molly Bird. And Molly is in the service industry here in New Orleans as well. And they are working on a program called Proof Positive Project to address this both locally and in a broader area. And they did a seminar that brought in a member of the New Orleans Police Department, a nurse specializing in sexual trauma. And it was a very interesting conversation and seminar. So we just play the part of the interview with Felicia and Scott talking about the issue. The reason why I bring this up and how it relates to Tales of the Cocktail is that this is an issue, of course, as I mentioned just a moment ago, becoming important, or I shouldn't say not becoming important, but becoming prevalent, addressed, talked about in the industry. Tales of the Cocktail is trying to address this. There's some things that we'll talk about Tales of the Cocktail and what it is and is not, maybe what it is and what it should be or shouldn't be. We'll get there at the end of the show. So first off, we're going to talk with the Pisco folks. And then second off, we are going to hear from Scott and Felicia Mayer on sexual violence in the industry. Two very important interviews that, in case you missed them, I want to make sure you hear them. And then, as I said, we're going to close out the show with a little bit of discussion on Tales of the Cocktail, what we're up to next week, some thoughts, different things like that, and how you can probably still go if you don't have tickets and all that stuff. Friends, I wanted to mention one event coming up. Draw your attention to that. It is taking place tomorrow evening. If you're listening here on the radio, it's, of course, Bastille Day, Friday, July 14th. And as we always do, we like to honor our French heritage here in New Orleans. And our good friends over there at the Windsor Court are doing, as they do every year, I believe, a Bastille Day dinner. And it is taking place in the grill room at Windsor Court. Chef de cuisine Gabrielle Charpentier. They're doing a price-fixed meal, as I mentioned, tomorrow evening, 6:30 p.m. It kicks off with a champagne reception, and at 7 p.m. is when you sit down for a full 6-course French meal paired with wines all the way through. So there's going to be stuff from Bordeaux, Sauvignon, and Alsace. If you're interested in reservations, 504-522-1994. Again, that's at the Windsor Court Hotel. And I just wanted to, I'm just looking at the menu here and it looks fantastic. Yeah, 6-course menu. So there's a champagne reception that you start out with. The first course, escargot. Man, and they're doing with some creme fraiche, herb saint, watercress soup. Wow, awesome. Frog legs for the second course. Third course, flavors of onion soup. Sounds great. Fourth course is salmon à la moutarde, mustard-crusted salmon. The fifth course is steak au poivre, peppered-crusted strip steak with truffle puree, pearl onion, braised fennel, baby turnip. I'm not reading everything on this. And then the dessert course is the Gâteau Concorde, grape cake should be then there with a raspberry sorbet. All this for $95. So you get a 6-course paired meal plus champagne with that delicious menu for $95. Not too bad. So check it out there at the Windsor Court. Celebrate. It's a great place to celebrate Bastille Day as we do here in the New Orleans area. Excuse me. Celebrating our French heritage here, an important part of everything that we are really in New Orleans. If you're interested in reservations, 6:30 for the champagne and 7 o'clock for the meal, 504-522-1994. Friends, thanks for tuning in here to the NOLA Drink Show. We're going to take a little break here and we're going to be back again, as I said, talking with Nathan Dalton, who is a Pisco guy, made made, worked in the service industry here, worked at the Catahoula Hotel, and also Matthew Noel, filmmaker of, or one of the two filmmakers of Pisco Punch, A Cocktail Comeback Story. Really, really interesting. And then right on the heels of that, again, Scott and Felicia Mayer talking about preventing sexual violence in the bar world, in the spirits industry, and connected areas. And then we'll be back to close out the show talking about Tales of the Cocktail. Friends, come on back.
The show is fine. Who's that next swing I said? The show is fine.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass Wine you drink.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu. Life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today. We are actually recording this from yesterday, or if you're listening to the podcast some days before. We're down in Houma at the home of Matthew and Becky Noel. Thanks for having us here, Matthew. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming, man.
Absolutely. And I'm also joined by Nathan Dalton. Thanks for being here, Nate.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we are here, very importantly, because Matthew, you're a filmmaker, and you recently completed a film, almost completed a film, called Pisco Punch, A Cocktail Comeback Story. It's a really wonderful documentary on Pisco, but I don't think that quite does it justice, does it? It's about a whole lot more.
Man, first off, thanks for coming down. It's been something that we've been working on for about 2 years, and it really does capture, I believe it captures the people, and that's the heart of it, and that's where it really takes off. Mm-hmm. Myself and also the director, Alan Croft, he's put in a lot of work as well, and it's just between two of us as co-filmmakers, and it's been an incredible journey.
It's a beautifully shot film. The story is great. You guys do it in five chapters, and I think one of the things that's really interesting about it is that it starts out where you guys kind of cover, like, here's what Pisco is from a beverage. And Nathan, you know this. We've done a couple shows where we've talked about Pisco as mm-hmm. a drink.
Yep.
And you are an expert in it, and you come from a strong bartending background with it. This story continues to carry on, where we really talk about how it's integrated into the culture, some of the struggles and successes more recently with Peru, and how it's an integral component in everything. And it really, in my view, tell me if I'm wrong, it uses Pisco to tell this as the vehicle really to tell a story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's really fun to see how it's not just located in Peru, it's branched out and where it's growing. And that's where, you know, Nathan comes into it as well. It's just a fantastic representative of where it's going. So it's really exciting to see that.
Well, and since you brought it up, Matthew, let's do this, Nathan. I know, again, we've talked about Pisco a little bit on the show, but let's go back to that. Let's talk about what is Pisco as a beverage, and what makes it special or what makes it different?
Yeah. How much time do you have? So
fair enough. Well, we got at least a segment on this, so we're good. You tell it the way you need to tell it.
Yeah, so pisco is a liquor that's made from grapes. So some would consider it a brandy, although in Peru they don't. They would consider a brandy to be a grape-based spirit that's been aged, whereas pisco is not aged. Pisco is an old spirit. It's over 500 years old. They started making it around 500. Into the 1500s, early 1600s, nobody's really sure as these things go, which puts it older than rum. You know, it's one of the OGs as far as major liquors are concerned.
What do you mean by OG, just so people know?
The original Glickers.
Glickers. I'm going to have to go back. Is that on Wikipedia?
Yeah. Original gangsters. So.
Yeah. It's not old granddad either.
No. So I'll come back a little bit to the history and the importance of it. But first I'll explain kind of what it is. It's a liquor that comes from grapes. And there's a big period at the end of that sentence. Everything that's in a bottle of pisco came from a grape. And you can't say that for any other type of liquor in the entire world that I'm aware of.
That's why it's not brandy, right? In a sense.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. You can't add anything throughout the entire process. So you pick the grapes, you squish the grapes, you get the grape juice out, you let the grapes ferment, but it has to be naturally. You're not allowed to add yeast to the process because that would be breaking the rules. You can't add anything, including yeast. So the yeast that exists naturally on the grape skins and the yeast that's floating in the air, those are the only types of yeast that can be used. So then you have the wine. You take the wine and you put it in a still, and you distill it one time in a pot still. It has to be a pot still, which is another big difference between a lot of liquors, because you can choose what kind of still you want to use. If you're a more commercial endeavor, and this is kind of talking in generalizations, but the more commercial liquors oftentimes will use column stills because it's more efficient. The more artisanal liquors typically use pot stills. In Peru, you have to use a pot still or a falca, which is kind of another story, kind of an older type of still that they made hundreds of years ago that aren't made anymore. But
so using traditional stills.
Traditional stills, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you distill it one time and only one time, which is another thing that makes it big time different from other liquors. Most liquors you distill twice or more, and then you end up with a liquor that's high proof, and you add water to bring it back down to the proof that you want. And so that kind of opens up a little can of worms, because a lot of ads you'll see on TV with vodkas, maybe our vodka was distilled 15 times. Mm-hmm. Like the more times you distill something, the better it's going to be. If you're going for absence of flavor, purity of purity is kind of a weird word, of ethanol, that's what you want to do. The more times you distill something, the higher the ethanol content, the less the water, and the less of every other chemical that started out in your original wine, beer, whatever you start with.
So you start losing flavor.
So you start losing flavor, exactly.
Well, and Nathan, hold that thought. Where you're going? Yep. I want you let me, because you guys captured this really well, Matthew, in the film, in that some of the people that were talking, as Nathan was saying, that it's sort of a... People picture distillation as I don't remember what the word was, but an extractive kind of process where we're purifying or doing something like this. And this was really a way that it's a concentrating process.
Yeah, and it's really cool to see that, because it's right there, as Nathan said. I mean, that's it. It's grapes, period. Mm-hmm. And that's the most exciting part about it, is what you put in is what you get out, mm-hmm, at the end of it.
Yeah. So you end up with the single distillate. Whatever comes out is what you get. You distill it to proof. You're not allowed to add water to bring it back down. And then you're not allowed to age it in oak barrels. And I like the parallel with tequila, because you have the different types of tequila. Blanco, Reposado is aged a little bit more. Añejo is aged even more. And the Añejo, a lot of people would argue, is like the smoothest form of tequila among the main three types. If you talk to a tequila purist, 9 times out of 10, they're going to prefer Blanco, because Blanco is not only is it like the pure tequila, but you know, if you have a good Blanco, then you have a good tequila. If you have a good Añejo, maybe you started out with a Blanco that was a little off. And in order to make it good, you covered up the imperfections with oak barrel aging.
Mm-hmm.
So with Pisco, that's impossible to do, because it's illegal. So yeah, what you get out of the still is what you get in the bottle. And that's incredible. And that brings into play terroir, brings into play climate, weather, year to year. Every year is going to be a little bit different, which I think is very exciting. A lot of liquors, because of the different leeway that you have as a master blender and as a distiller, you can make sure that each batch tastes the same.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes out some of the intricacies
in the vintage. And, you know, and something that I want to mention here that I think it is interesting is that, you know, it compares to wine in a sense,
mm-hmm.
and that we have this complexity of notes. But one of the things that I took away from the film and conversations I've had with you, and something that we didn't talk about last time, actually, is that you have this beverage that has that complexity that wine does with those notes, but we're dealing with a spirit. Mm-hmm. So that changes its ability to work in a cocktail, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what it brings to the table to a cocktail, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Yeah, and it's going to be different. It's not exactly just a more concentrated wine flavor, because when you distill, there are certain things that are, certain molecules that are too heavy to distill over into a final product. So it's a different product. I don't know a lot of people that would taste Pisco and be like, oh, this tastes like wine. It's different, but in essence, all that's in there is wine.
Is wine, yeah. Right, exactly. Well, you guys, let's do this, because what I want to do here, we'll take a little break if that's all right with y'all, and then come back and let's talk a little bit more about the cultural component. Let's talk a little bit about what the film shows. I think we've covered, you know, the beverage really well, and then let's get into some of the story of again, the cultural integration of Pisco and so much more, Matthew, of what you guys captured in the beautiful film that you made. Is that cool?
That sounds great, man.
All right. You guys come on back here to the NOLA Drink Show. We'll be right back after this. We're talking Pisco. Come on back.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
The French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer, and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
This is Christopher Icaza, general manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucaray. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's grand dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon dining room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Noel Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in today here on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. I'm sitting here with Matthew Noel, filmmaker down here in HOMA, who was, again, kind enough, to let us into his home. And Nathan Dalton, you're the food and beverage director at Catahoula?
Yep.
You are? Okay, so there you go. And also Pisco Man About Town in New Orleans. Thanks for being here, you guys. And so the film is called Pisco Punch, A Cocktail Comeback Story. And again, beautiful film, Matthew, that you and Alan have made. And we were just talking during the break that I think it's all very compelling, but there's this really compelling shot at the beginning, more or less after you cover Pisco, and we're rolling through the Ica Desert, and it's from above, and we just see that totally barren, fine sand desert, and then boom, it comes over, and then we see something else.
Man, Alan and I have been down to Peru, Ica specifically, three times, and every time we go down there, there's a 4-hour trip and you just pass desert after desert. You know, it's just barren. There's nothing there. And Nathan puts it really well. There's nothing, not even a cactus.
Yeah. Not even a tumbleweed, as you said earlier. Yeah. Right?
and it's hard to put it into words because we were trying to wrap our heads on how to show that. And I just wanted this shot of just revealing the Ica Valley. It's magical. It really is, because it looks like a giant oasis in a way. If you can imagine like a kid's version of an oasis, that kind of has that. Yeah, it's got that vibe to it. And this, you know, it just pops up out of nowhere. And so we were looking for that. We took a dune buggy, and so we're riding out into the desert, and we're out of this area called Huacachina, and it's right near the edge of Ica. And so we're trying to find this, but these dunes are huge. They're giant and thousands of feet tall, you know, and I brought my quadcopter. So I'm trying to fly this thing.
That's a
to
drone,
show
right?
it. Yeah. The Just drone. Yes. Okay. Yes. Drone. Sorry. And I really felt like that's the only way to get that perspective, but it was extremely windy. These dunes are extremely tall. It's deceptively tall. But so we're looking for it. And I tried to fly it a couple of times. No, you know, we got some good shots of lots of sand. Lots of sand. But, you know, that reveal shot was eluding us. And finally, we could see the dune that we wanted to get to, but our driver was like, no, we can't get down because we wouldn't be able to get back. And so Alan and I looked at each other. We're like, you know, we don't get this opportunity ever. It's like making the whole film. You know, we don't get this opportunity. We better do what the best possible thing we can. And so we hoofed it. We walked all the way there, and it was about a mile and a half. And Diego's sitting back there, one of the producers. He's sitting by the thing waiting for us. So it's like an hour before they even see us pop up again. And we get all the way to this edge, and I tried to launch the drone, and the winds are probably 20 miles an hour or something like that. Mm-hmm. Some 15, 20 miles an hour. And it blows it over off the little box. I was launching it off a peak. There's nothing flat, you know, it's all these giant things. Anyway, so it falls over and it gets sand in the motor. And we're like, okay, well, that's it for the drone shots. Like, we thought that's it, done. So I spend some time, do some repairs live and in that spot. And I'm like, you know what? We're just going to try it again. It doesn't matter if this thing, you know, doesn't work after this. We're really going to try it. So put it up in the air and we find the spot. And as you crest over the top of this giant sand dune, you start to peek over and see this beautiful desert. The desert opens up into this lush, all these different beautiful vineyards. Mm-hmm. And you can really see it. And it's
that's one of the moments in the movie where you're just like awestruck.
It's striking. I mean, and it sets up so much of the film from there on out, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I'm just really happy that we pushed. And anybody doing anything, you know, whether it's a film or anything, I hope that they, you know, push past those little bits, because I felt like we earned that shot, you know, and it really helped translate that. I'm just really proud about that shot.
It's beautiful. And it's absolutely beautiful. And Nathan, coming back to you on this, so we see this reveal shot, as Matthew has very nicely described, and it's, as we're talking about here, it's shocking, it's awestruck, striking, you know, and all that. And then we see these vineyards, and I think what then struck me at that point from, I guess, sort of a practical person with a practical wine background that I have, is that how are people growing grapes here? It's all irrigation, right?
Yeah, it's all
it doesn't rain in the growing season.
Okay, so... this is actually very interesting. They have what they call flood irrigation. If you have money, you can do irrigation from a well. A lot of people don't have enough money to do that. And so you're talking about the smaller growers. So a lot of times these vines don't see rain or don't see water except for one time a year. It's a really cool story. There was a guy, there was an Incan king.
Oh, yeah.
Pachacuti.
Yeah, I love this story.
Who fell in love with this girl who was like a peasant from this town near the coast in Ica. She was too poor, and, you know, I guess it was kind of the same thing that you had in Europe. Like, you're a royalty, you can't marry a peasant or whatever. So he says, sorry, I can't marry you, but what can I do to prove my love, to show my love to you? And she said, bring water to my people. And so he did. And so I can't remember how far it is, but it's like 1,000 miles, or maybe it's not that far, but hundreds of miles, right? Of canal.
Absolutely. Miles. Yeah. Let's go with many miles.
From the top of the mountain, where the snow runoff would happen, down to this town, down to this village. And to this day, that's the canal that they still use to irrigate the grapes. And one time a year, the water will flood down from the mountain, and the vineyards are down in these bowls that are surrounded by walls with one opening in the wall. And the opening opens onto the canal. And so when the canal fills with water, the vineyards fill with water, and they sit there for as long as the water will last. And when the water finally subsides into the earth, that's it for the grapes.
That's it.
Yeah.
And something, Matthew, that you guys captured in the film, I thought was interesting, and Nathan mentioned this earlier, that it's not allowed to introduce outside yeast, which is very common. I mean, it's what everybody does in the wine world for the most part. And so those wild yeasts are actually allowed to propagate on the grape skins because we don't get rain during the growing season. And you were interviewing some of the growers too, where that they're only introducing organic materials.
Yeah. And you can see it. You can see it on there. And I mean, it's the coolest thing because it tastes different. And they say that, you know, you can definitely taste the difference between something that's manufactured, you know, and the real honest yeast that's growing there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I learned something really interesting about yeast. One time when we were doing a dinner, actually with Diego a couple of years ago, like a Peruvian dinner, Darren tells the cocktail. And I wanted to make chicha, which is the stuff that they make up in the mountains. Everybody in Peru, chicha is what they used to chew the corn and spit it into the bucket. And so I was like, we're going to make that. So I went down there and I learned how to do it from this lady that was making it, wrote down every single detail. And I came back and I tried to do it in New Orleans, tried to naturally ferment, and it didn't work.
Just so people are clear on that, you're using your spit and your saliva to cause natural fermentation of the corn, right?
There are two ways to do it. I didn't do it that way, although I think next time I'm going to try.
Okay.
there's also a way you can grind it up and boil it and then go about it that way. So that's what I was doing since I was expecting other people to drink it. But
that was very big of him.
It tasted like absolute crap. And so I went, I ended up going to Brewstock, which is the brewer store uptown, to see if I could get some advice. told them what I was doing, and they said, "You're trying to naturally ferment in New Orleans?" And they like died laughing at me. The yeast here that we do have sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's how big of a difference yeast makes. And so they gave me a vial of yeast to use, and I never brewed beer. I'm ashamed to say. I've been wanting to do it for years, but I unscrewed the cap from the yeast, and it bubbled all over my face and all over my clothes, and it smelled just like German beer that I had. And I was like, oh, that's where that flavor comes from. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the organism that creates the alcohol. It adds big time amount of flavor.
Absolutely.
And you can't get the yeast that's in Peru unless you're in Peru.
So, right. And that's only going to be natural to the environmental conditions there. Yeah. Well, you guys, let's do this. Let's take a break. I want to come back and talk more about, let's talk about the history, because there's an interesting connection, Matthew, with Pisco and Peru and the west coast of the United States, San Francisco to be particular. And you guys talk a lot about that in the film.
Absolutely.
Cool, folks. Coming back to the Noel Drink Show. We'll be right back.
When I get through walking these blues, when I get back to New Orleans, suitcase in my hand. Now ain't that a shame? I'm leaving here today. Yes, I'm going back home to stay. Yes, I'm walking to New Orleans.
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Baggio heads up the Small Plates and Charcuterie Kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're gonna stay here till it's to our soul. It takes all that long. Come on and let the good times roll. We're gonna stay here till it's to our soul. It takes all that long.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Noel Drinks Show. Welcome back to the Noel Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you, chatting with Matthew Noel and Nathan Dalton, and we're talking about the documentary Pisco Punch, A Cocktail Comeback Story. And when we left for the break, Matthew, we were talking a little bit about another phase of the story that you guys talked about was the history of Pisco as it, let's put it this way, left Peru. And it's a fascinating story about the connection with Peru to San Francisco.
Man, it's interesting. And I know we talked a little bit off there that you come from that area.
I'm from the Bay Area originally.
Yeah, Bay Area.
Yep.
And one of the coolest things about doing our premiere in Napa Valley at the Napa Valley Film Festival was that there was a lot of Bay Area locals there. And this story resonated so strong with them because it's an area where they didn't know what was going on in their own backyard and with the Pisco Punch, because what happened was you had it die off. You know, the Pisco was just gone for a long period of time after Prohibition, and it was exciting to see that, you know, this cocktail that was right under their nose just gets brought back in. And what really happened was the people were making the way down, the sailors, they were coming down South America. They would run out of rum going around the bay and stop in Lima, and they would refuel with Pisco
because that's grounds for mutiny. Grounds for mutiny if you run out of booze.
Yeah. and so it ended up making its way up to San Francisco at the final port, you know. And so this grew from that space there, and it's really cool to see that that a lot of people from that San Francisco area didn't know a lot about that, and it resonated.
Yeah, and so we have so Pisco was very popular going back. I mean, it's an old spirit. I think a lot of people don't know that it's something that was in the canon of like rum and whiskey, a few things that were present going back to the mid-19th century here. So as you said, I mean, we're talking about the gold rush time.
Yeah.
Is that it was wild, presumably wildly, but very popular, at least in San Francisco, and I'm assuming miners getting their hands on it up in gold country and things like that.
One of the my favorite things is Duggan McDonald talks about how it was the most expensive cocktail back during that time.
In the Western world.
In the Western world during that time, yeah. And that's really kind of cool to wrap your head around that, because you have, you know, New York going on, all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, you have this kind of hidden drink now that's popping back up that you can now taste what that would have been like, at least close to it. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so the Pisco Punch, and Nathan, we didn't really mention this. Nathan was one of the stars of the film.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think we have to cover that.
Absolutely.
I wanted to get his autograph, actually, when I was sitting next to him on the couch. But
$20.
already? Wow. But you were talking about the Pisco Punch, and it's got an interesting story. So, I mean, it's a drink that, again, sort of mid-19th century, there's a secret ingredient that's going on there. Nickel, took the recipe to his grave.
Yep. Duncan Nickel owned the bank exchange out in San Francisco, and the recipe was a secret.
And the bank exchange saloon, right? It was a bar.
Yeah.
A saloon. Yep.
Yeah. A lot of bars back then, I think, were called bank exchanges. People would go there for business purposes. And so this was the big one in San Francisco. And secret recipe, the story is he would go down in a basement and whip a batch up with only his trusty sidekick, who was blind and... No, he was just deaf. He was deaf mute.
Okay.
So that was kind of like... I guess his assurance that the recipe wouldn't, spread, because he was very guarded about it. And one reason that people think he probably was that guarded about it was because recently in 1914, cocaine was outlawed, and that probably was an ingredient in the Pisco Punch.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that based on, I guess, circumstantial evidence and because of the way people say that it made them feel after they drank it,
And its use in other beverages that is documented.
Exactly. Coca-Cola and all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Maybe that's why it was a secret. Yeah.
That makes all the sense in the world. So this very strong connection to San Francisco, which is really interesting. And then, bringing it back to Peru, and Matthew, you mentioned that Prohibition had an extreme effect on all kinds of alcohol, obviously, in this country in particular, where... It caused a lot of things to go away, and Pisco was certainly one of them. But I think then you fast forward a few years, a few decades really, but it doesn't make a comeback in the United States. And then we hit 1968 in Peru, which was a major political change, and that had a huge effect on Pisco production.
It was devastating. So you had the agrarian reform, and they tried to fix some things that were going on in the country. And politically, they've just had this long history of a lot of trouble, whether it's, you know, the politicians, or it's, you know, even to terrorism, which it eventually got into in the 70s, 80s, and Shining Path, Tupac Amaro. Mm-hmm. And this struggle there, it's not just like, oh, it was bad. We had the opportunity to sit down with people where they were like having these experiences in their school, and they grew up in it, knowing that bombings were a way of life. We grew up, and then some of the one of the growers from Vista Alegre, they built this beautiful distillery, and you know, it's kind of a ghost distillery now. And during the time when they ripped up all the during that the earlier part when they ripped up some of the grapes.
So they were seizing land. The government was seizing
the land. Yeah, back in the 60s,
and then giving it away for basically co-op farming, and the grapes got torn out of the ground.
Yeah, and it's just it's heartbreaking to have this interview with somebody that they lost a huge portion of their life. You're dealing with, you know, from 68-ish or whatever to now, and it's just getting back.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular place never came back online to this day.
So we were talking, I think, with that particular distillery then, in 67, they were anticipating that, hey, you know, Pisco is going to go somewhere. We're going to up our production
majorly,
and get ready to export this stuff to you know, so-called first world markets. And then all of a sudden, this hits, and not only did it capped off business going anywhere, but it pushed things, as you're saying, back decades. I mean, grapes were torn out of the ground, for the most part. Old vines are desirable when we're making grapes. So a lot of just the overall agricultural production behind the grapes themselves disappeared overnight almost.
Absolutely. And it goes down to just a few people in that area in Ica. And it's nice to see now that some of these families that have been around and held on to that, they're proud to be able to do it still. And they held on through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, that's a long time to keep doing something with your heart when everything is telling you to stop. Overcome that. And it's incredible to see each of these families and each of these people and people who have the passion, that they did it.
Right,
they're doing it right now, and we can be a part of it by buying a bottle of Pisco, to learn about their cuisine, learn about the history, learn about what it takes to make a bottle of this, and how that really is history in a glass. And I know that's
it's a great point. And actually it's a really great point. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about sort of the positive turn on things. And I think adding to what we're talking about here, to the small number, presumably, of families that continue to make Pisco in the film. There's a quote where, you know, it's a culturally integrated beverage. So, you know, babies are born, Pisco is consumed. Somebody dies, Pisco is consumed. So I think, my speculation, and you can vouch for this or not, from your experience, that was what allowed it to actually hang on, is that it was so culturally integrated and necessary to the culture that it probably would have gone away had it not had that kind of importance.
Yeah, it's so integrated. Absolutely.
Well, you guys, let's do this. Let's take another break, and then I want to come back, because we're now kind of went through the dark days, as you guys call that, was chapter 3, I think, in the film. And let's come back and talk about a lot of the positive, which there is a lot of that now. Is that cool?
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, coming back to the NOLA Drink Show.
Shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans.
Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint, and it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc. Cheers!
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirits Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show here on WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. Brian Diaz here with you, and we are chatting Pisco in HOMA. Go, you know, who'd have thunk it that we'd be down in HOMA talking about Pisco, but we're in the home of Matthew Noel's filmmaker, who has produced a lovely documentary that we're talking about here, Pisco Punch, A Cocktail Comeback Story, also joined by Nathan Dalton, who is the food and beverage manager there at Catahoula Hotel. And we're talking about kind of pacing our way through the film. And one of my favorite quotes in the film, and you guys forgive me for I jotted it down, I didn't catch who said it, but the what we're talking about, the break, is how things almost disappeared, and one of the gentlemen in the film came back and said, the Pisco story is being rescued poco a poco, meaning little by little. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really neat way to tell it. And you guys captured that incremental process, I think, fantastically in the film.
Yeah, and I think that was Gaston. Is that correct? I don't know. Gaston Curio, he's a chef.
Might have been.
Is it?
I think he was speaking a lot of English.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, this was actually in Spanish, and so he said.
Oh yeah. And, yeah.
That's why he used the term poco poco, little by little.
Oh, that was Amaz.
His son.
Amaz. Oh, was it Pedro? Okay.
Okay. So
that guy. We're rewatching the movie now.
That guy.
That sentiment has been shared across a bunch of the people there, and that we came across, Alan and I, And it's true. I mean, you're starting to see these small steps that they've taken. And yes, they went through hard times, but it's pretty cool. And it ties into, you know, South Louisiana a lot too, because we don't give up. We just, we're pretty stubborn in a lot of ways, in a good way, to where we're fighting for what we believe in. And I think these families that were producing the Pisco, the people who were, really creating these, taking these dishes, the food that was there, that the gastronomy and everything, and bringing it up to another level. You know, you've got Chef Pedro from Malabar, and Gaston Acorio, Astrid Gaston, a ton of other restaurants. But I mean, they're doing some really fantastic stuff now. But those are all the vehicles to bring that culture and the people and the care and love from them to people here now. And it's not just within the country. It's coming by people like Nathan right now and Catahoula.
Thanks. I just wanted to jump in and say really fast, just to your point, I just think it's fascinating that I think it's the World Travel Awards have designated Lima, Peru to be the top culinary destination in the world 4 years in a row, which is unheard of. Over New York, over Paris, over the entire planet.
And it's easy. It's so easy to get around in Lima. I mean, once you get from the airport, once you get from the airport, it's not, it's not giant. And it's beautiful. You've got the beach right there, which means that there's wonderful seafood. Japanese fishing boats are right outside of their legal waters fishing those same fish that they're trying to get,
Great, yeah.
So just to let you know, like, it's really good. And they've got these huge influences of you know, Chinese food and Japanese food, and it's just amazing to see the Spanish, Amazonian,
Italian,
and the stuff coming from the Amazon is insane. Mm-hmm. They're taking roots and barks and you know, making these different things that are going into not just food but also beverage. And you're seeing that paired with, you know, the piscos and the fresh fruits and things that are there. It's pretty cool. And that's just making its way out. Yeah. Every time I see Nathan, he's got something else. He's some new thing that he's brought back or found a purveyor or somebody who's able to bring something. And it's like, oh, you got to try this. This is something cool, you know. And he's bringing that to people here. And that's exciting.
And you can look at it from the other direction also. Like what has Peru given to the rest of the world throughout history? Without Peru, we wouldn't have had all these different types of incredible cuisines. Like potatoes come from Peru. So what about, yep, what's Ireland without potatoes?
Absolutely.
Tomatoes come from Peru. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine Italian food? Peppers come from Peru. Half of them, at least, Peru and Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
What's, you know, Thai food and Chinese food without peppers? And so much more. Beans come from Peru. I mean, it's incredible the influence that Peru's had on the world, and nobody realizes it.
People don't realize that, and I think that's important. And it, go ahead, Matthew, you're going to say something.
Yeah, the Incans, I believe that with their farming, well, the Incans were really good at a lot of different things. So they were great at building, master builders. And you can see this in Cusco, where they've got some of these rocks that have been chiseled and you can't even fit a credit card in between it, but it was hand done. How in the world do they have that ability way back then?
Right on the edge of a cliff.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's amazing.
Irrigation was a big one.
Yeah, irrigation. And then the terrace farming. Mm-hmm. And what I learned is that... you know, they took, it's not that they were just good at this. They looked around with the people who were in that, you know, in South America, and they were like, hey, you're really good at farming, right? And they're like, you know, a neighboring country, and they're like, hey, you're really good at farming. Let's make you a god over here. And they brought people in as like, hey, we're going to make you a, you know, a superhero, basically, you know, of the, and so they pulled the best of the best. So they've got the engineering, the farming, the irrigation, all that kind of stuff. And they really just pulled it all together. And you know, potatoes, there's like 2,000 varieties of potatoes.
They have a museum for potatoes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
The potatoes are awesome.
It's a cool story. And you know, and let's jump to that, to the cuisine thing, because you guys point this out in the film that the pisco, as we were talking about, is integrated into the culture. It's integrated into the gastronomy in Peru. And so we see that a lot of the Peruvian cuisine is now starting to be recognized for what it is. It's been elevated because people now start to have that economic wherewithal, ingredient, I'll use that term, wherewithal, and we see it being exported, and there's pisco sort of riding on the train with the food, I guess is maybe a way to put it.
Yeah.
And you know, so then something like what you guys have done at Catahoula, places that we see all over the world now, you know, introducing Peruvian cuisine to the world, but on a higher level, and then there's pisco.
Yeah, exactly. And the way that I see it, Peru, and I like to make this parallel. After Katrina, everyone came back and wanted to rebuild, and was so proud to be from New Orleans and proud to be a part of the rebuild and doing whatever they can. And we all had bumper stickers on our cars and New Orleans on our shirts. And it's the exact same way now with Peru. Everyone has shirts that say Peru, and the buses go past and they say Peru on them, and hats. And it's just, people are proud of their heritage, and they're getting back into their ancient religions and their Quechua language and all this stuff, kind of for the first time for a lot of these people that have been taught that this stuff is lower than Western society. Now they're very prideful of it, which is amazing.
That was a great point. And actually, just to kind of highlight that a little bit, somebody else that you all interviewed in the film said, you know, and I never really thought about it this way in that sense, in that all of this happened with all the political upheaval and economic ruin, political violence, terrorism, all of this stuff that we're talking about. And one person said that what happened is that we started to think our culture was less valuable than everyone else's culture. Mm-hmm. That psychological component of that beatdown that comes with this.
Yeah.
And now the joy that's coming out with the culture, it's a renaissance, I think, maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's exciting to watch.
Yeah,
sure. And it's something that you don't even just have to watch. You can be a part of, because every time you take a bite or a sip of something from Peru, you're just spreading that. I mean, that's what it's about. And that's what they would do in their home.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they hope you do here, you know, and share it with your friends. And, you know, I really implore the listeners to go out and try a pisco beverage, but not just one. Try a couple of different kinds, because they're so different. Try the food, you know, it goes together for a reason, because it's good together.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that's that energy and that pride embodied, the cuisine and the pisco that they're exporting to the world.
Yeah, it's the ambassador, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's great. So, you guys, what we're going to do here is we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back with some of your bartending team, Nathan there at Catahoula, and talk about some of their affinity for Pisco. And then if you guys are good, we'll come back with Matthew and Nathan a little bit more, talk a little bit more about where things are going with the film, and talk a little bit more about Catahoula, probably where we can find y'all, and we'll talk a little bit more about Pisco. I think that's what we're talking about here.
Great. Yeah.
Cool. Everybody, come on back to the NOLA Drink Show.
Catholic church bells toll the Louisiana blues.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 after 5 happy hour special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event, or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans, or if you're listening to the podcast, however you're listening to the show, thank you very much. As you know, we're here at the Southern Regional Meeting for the United States Bartenders Guild, that we are fortunate enough to host the annual meeting here in New Orleans this year. And as we talked about in a previous segment with Aaron and Cole, a lot of this, we're doing issue-based stuff, important things, not just how to make a drink. And my next two guests presented in a seminar yesterday on a very important issue about preventing sexual violence in the industry. So I'm joined by Felicia Mayer and Scott Mayer. Thanks so much for being here, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you guys are married, hence the same last name.
Yes.
And Scott, you are the brand advocacy and education director for Fratelli Branca.
Yes, I am.
And I'm going to talk right, don't be shy.
Oh, absolutely.
There
yes,
we go.
I
cool,
am.
Cool. And Felicia, you are a counselor that yes. specializes in sexual violence.
That's correct.
Now, one of the things is, you know, we've talked about on the show before with Molly Bird and Mark Shetler, we've talked about this issue to some degree, starting to address it, understanding that this is maybe a unique or peculiar space in a way, and where sexual violence can quite easily occur. You two have put together a program coming from your background, Scott, in the alcohol business, and Felicia, your background counseling, to address this.
Yes, we absolutely have. And one of the, I mean, after there are a number of different incidents in the last year or so where this issue kept popping up, and one of the things I had to make a decision about was how do you respond to that as a brand, as a concerned person in the industry, as a bartender, you know, how do we respond to this as an industry? And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and realized that there was a lot of people who are interested in helping and wanted to be involved in this, and not a lot of people who were actually qualified to put it together. Mm-hmm. And thought about who would be qualified to put this together. And, you know, after smacking myself in the head a few times, I realized I'm married to the person who's able to put this together.
A little slow on the uptake there, Scott.
A little slow on the uptake. So at that point, I had a conversation with Felicia and brought her in on the conversation. I'm curious as to what your thoughts were at that point. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think it's been about a year we started talking about this, and you know, it's a issue that's very dear to my heart that I've worked on for many, many years, and it's such a unique space, I think, to bring it into, to be able to talk to people in the bar business, because we know that a large percentage of sexual assaults do involve alcohol. And alcohol not being the cause, of course, but alcohol does play a role. So, you know, people in the bar industry are in a really unique position to do something about it in terms of intervening when they see something happening and addressing these issues. They're on the front line, you could say, in some ways.
I think that's a great way to put it, because it is a very unique space. And what would, because of the things that you just mentioned, Felicia, what are some of the challenges in addressing it in this unique space? I mean, there's a good old boys club kind of mentality, I think, that goes on in the bar industry and some other things. It's a challenging space to address this issue, is it not?
Well, so there are many. I mean, it's challenging to address anywhere.
Sure.
But I think, you know, so we have to say that there's a lot of different levels. So one level is the people working in bars and their guests, right? So there's dealing with sexual assault in that way, in that people are coming into their bars, there are things happening, and they can, you know, people who are working in that business can do something about it if they can, you know, pay attention and see what's going on and see the signs. And you know, of course, there are challenges, like you've got, you know, it's Saturday night and you've got a you know, huge crowd, and how are you going to intervene in things and see everything that's going on? You've got like that level of challenge, and also just getting the proper training to know what to do in those situations. But then, you know, I think the challenge that really showed up that had this start in the first place was...
Can I interject for just a moment?
Sure.
There's actually some really great organizations inside of the industry and on the periphery of the industry that deal directly with, I mean, what we're really talking about right here is bystander training and
right.
for bartenders. And there's Safe Bars out of Washington, D.C., and Outsmart out of New York City, and Proof Positive here in New Orleans will be at the place to do these kind of trainings. This conversation, I think, to some degree, and where Felicia was going with it, and I'll turn it right back to her in a second, is about internally. How do we deal with the culture of bars?
And Scott, that's sort of what I was getting at, is that, you know, I think when we have a situation, and I'm not, to your point, Felicia, exactly, that it's difficult to deal with anywhere, but some of the formal mechanisms that you get in, say, a corporate setting, and I don't say they always work, don't get me wrong, but the good old boys club and things like that. But when you put alcohol in the mix, a legal drug, and so much of the culture of footloose and fancy free or a carefree space, some of that dynamic, I think, is at least a little bit different. I mean, any circumstance,
yes,
I guess, would be.
Yeah, and actually what comes to mind is a sort of a comparison, like people say, like, oh, it's locker room talk.
Right.
Right? Similar kind of a thing, except in a bar. And, you know, it's like we talked about in the seminar that I think there's a, you know, this traditionally behind the bar and in front of it, right? It was a male space. And women are now occupying those roles both behind and in front of the bar. And so, yeah, there is sort of a... it's become sort of normalized, and then when you add alcohol into the mix, and I think all those things get brought out even more. So, you know, there's that challenge, and also, you know, the challenge on both levels of knowing, like, where does it cross the line from, you know, people are having a good time, people are joking around, to wait a minute, this is not okay, this is harassment, this is assault, this is getting out of line, this is being disrespectful, and you know, all of those things, and being able to deal with that. It's definitely a challenge in this space. And like Scott was saying, too, the things that happened, there are things that happened within the industry. So, you know, sexual assault.
And feel free to elaborate. I mean, we've talked about it on the show and we've named names.
So. Oh, sure.
Go, I mean, and you don't have to if you don't want to. It's out there.
You put
already.
18,000 people together for Tales of the Cocktail here in New Orleans. Absolutely. And there are going to be some predators out there, and predators that we know and that, you know, we believe are our friends. You know, we've talked about Alex Strauss. I would have considered him a friend, you know. And people are like, well, are you afraid to bring his name up? I'm like, no. He sexually assaulted women in our industry and other friends of mine as well. And that's not okay. And I have no problem saying that publicly. And there are, you know, even the conference we're at currently, there are a number of opportunities for bartenders to be together and to do a lot of drinking together if they want to. And on top of that, it's a really ripe environment for a predator.
And thank you for saying that, because when you mentioned that word too, and I know, again, we touched on a little bit of this with Mark and Molly, but I think what people want to often do in this space is, like as you said at the beginning, Felicia, blame alcohol. And what it is it's an environment that allows predation and predators to operate, perhaps for lack of a better way to put it, effectively or more effectively from their perspective than in other environments. Because you have alcohol going on, you can take advantage of people, their lack of judgment,
yes,
and so on.
To use it really as a date rape drug.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, we didn't really talk about this so much, but I think in some ways, although I think definitely, and we talked about one, there are people out there who we could say they're predators, that they are like really looking for opportunities to do this, like over and over again, and take advantage of the situation, and even put themselves in situations where, like, oh, this is a great opportunity where I can get someone really drunk, or multiple people, or, you know, be in these situations. And also, it's very often people who are well respected, and
using their position of power,
using their position of real or perceived power, exactly. But I also I want to be careful about labeling people predators. Not the ones who are, we should label them that. But what I'm saying is, sometimes there are things, like, you know, we hear all the time about date rape, and there are, I guess, I think in some ways it's easy to say, like, oh, well, there are predators and there are people who are not predators. And if we just put everyone who's a predator in this category, then we're not looking about some of the stuff that's going on all the time, that maybe that person is not, like, what am I trying to say?
Making bad decisions, but they're not actively out to predate on someone on a regular basis. Like, yeah. Hunting, if you will, going, yes, to bars and looking to predate.
Yeah, because this kind of stuff happens in subtle ways, too, all the time. I mean, all you have to do is look in advertisements, right? I mean, so it's like, or in the media, that or our president, you know, that there's although I'm not going to go there. So what I'm saying is, like, there are situations all the time where, and I'm going to say men, but we know that this happens, that women are sometimes the perpetrators of this as well. But that there are men who will push beyond, will take something without consent.
And can you guys do me one favor? Can you hold that thought, please? And we got to take a quick little break here. We're going to come back and continue the conversation. Folks, come on back to the very important conversation here on the NOLA Drink Show.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc. A great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
This is Christopher Icaza, General Manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucaray. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's Grand Dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon Dining Room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
The French Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our 6-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffuletta, po' boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmer's market. Check out our pop-up farmer's markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time, the full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. 716 Iberville.
We are chatting with Felicia and Scott Mayer. We are talking about preventative measures, opportunities to take advantage of resources that are out there to prevent sexual violence in the bar industry. And Felicia, let's come right back to what you were talking about.
Yeah, glad we took that little break. Give me a chance to get a little bit of clarity in my mind of where we're going. Yes. So I guess I just wanted to say that that's part of why we talked yesterday in the seminar about rape culture, because there are so many different levels of how we as a culture and a society make it okay to introduce violence or basically doing anything of a sexual nature with someone else's bodies without their consent. Or giving these messages of like, you know, if a woman says no, she really means yes.
Right. And there, and so much of that is still prevalent. Like you said, we're locker room talk, some of these things. Let me ask you this too, because I've heard people say this both from a practical, functional level about addressing this issue, and I've also heard people say this in pushing back, that, you know, bars are supposed to be fun spaces. Okay, don't bring this stuff into bars. Don't want to talk about politics, don't want to talk about religion, and I want to have my locker room talk. And I think that's still very, very prevalent, is it not? And it's a significant issue in what we're talking about.
I mean,
here,
as having been in this business, you know, more than 20 years at this point, what I'll say is I agree with that we shouldn't talk about politics, that you shouldn't talk about money, that these are not that there should be a level of, you know, of fun, and it should be a safe space. And but also those not talking about politics and money creates a safe space for people to just have a good time and relax. Creating a safe space, this actually talking about this subject creates a safe space for everyone to have a good time and relax,
right,
as well.
Right.
It's not this, you can't even look at them as the same thing.
And I think it's fair, and I agree with you. I think it's fair to say, you know, we go back to that salon concept and things like that. You know, if you want to talk, I think you need to be able to talk politics in a bar if that's what you want to do, but you need to be able to remove yourself from it if you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is a place to exchange ideas, I think.
Sure.
And it's a place where we can actually talk about what you all are talking about in an effective way because you have an engaged audience. Do you think that's fair?
Yes, and I think in settings like this conference, you know, I mean, we're not talking about like, oh, when you're at your bar, you should be talking about sexual assault. It's actually about preventing. It's right. It's about preventing it, and it's also about not talking. So we're not saying you shouldn't talk about sex when you're at a bar. We're not talking about that. You know, you shouldn't be. You know, that. I mean, listen, people. A lot of people or single people are going to bars because they want to hook up, and that's totally
right.
Fine,
right.
As long as there's consent. And you know, part of the laws talk about basically being under the influence and being able to give consent or not. So.
Right.
Which is a very tricky issue, too, that we addressed yesterday.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
I mean, I really think that one of the great points that came out, it was not something we had originally planned on being said in the seminar, but really came out of the seminar yesterday, is that we are, as bartenders, having been in this industry as long as I have, our attention to alcohol and driving, what it was
right.
years ago as
right.
opposed to what it is now, I think as an industry, we've gotten much better at it. I don't think anyone in the room yesterday would have hesitated to grab somebody's keys from them or call them an Uber or a Lyft or a taxi or, you know, make sure that, or drive them home themselves even at certain points.
Right.
We're really good at stopping people from hurting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, at the end of the day, what's the worst thing that can happen from that is death, right?
That's pretty bad.
Right. Yeah. Pretty bad.
Those two parts.
And what's the worst thing that can happen about this is what's probably the next worst thing is rape.
Yeah. Right.
And, we don't actually act that way. So, I mean, this was really the first opportunity that we had to create a step change in the business and like really shift everybody's attitudes to, I care as much about this as I do about my patrons going home drunk and being alive the next day.
Yeah, and that's really, you know, and just we got about 3 minutes left, guys, so I want to make sure we get to what we get to. But there's two parts of this, I think, here, and I want to clarify this for the listeners. Some of what's going on in the training is giving bartenders and others tools to prevent. But there is also the issue of changing the mentality and the culture, the longer-term solution of recognition, behavioral change, these things. Is that fair? We sort of have a two-pronged attack here?
Yes. Yeah. And one of the things we talked about yesterday is if you, you know, it's so important to train bartenders on these skills and be able to help their guests, but that change also has to come behind the bar among staff. And like you alluded to before, like that good old boy culture. And, you know, there's a lot of, I think, because I've listened to your podcast before, I can say ass. So there's a lot of grab ass.
You can say that.
There's a lot of grab ass that goes on.
Not one of the
on.
Seven words. You're good.
So you can, you know, there's a lot of grab ass that goes on behind the bar. And listen, that's a level of it. It's going on without consent. And that sends a message that it's okay to grab somebody without their consent. And I think, you know, that speaks to one example of how that culture exists among people in the business.
Right. Right. Thank you. Scott, you wanted to mention Carpino?
Yeah.
Before we get to
yep. So when we started, after we thought about how we would present this, I was lucky enough to speak with the powers that be at Fratelli Branca and basically decide this for this year and possibly going forward for as long as it works and as long as we can make a difference, that Carbono Vermouth is a product that many people use to make low ABV cocktails, keep the levels, you know, low and keep the party going for a long time, as opposed to getting real drunk real fast. Mm-hmm. So that's a it, it's in itself is a level of social responsibility, and we thought that we could actually, because of that, had a little bit of a leg to stand on to go out and, you know, talk about social responsibility inside of this industry and have the difficult conversations. And I really just want to acknowledge the brand for being so forward thinking about that and allowing us to do this and giving us the resources to do this.
Excellent. You two, thank you so much for being here. One of the things that we were talking about during the break, we recorded the presentation yesterday. So as soon as we do a little bit of cleanup on some things, we'll be getting you the video. We'll be sharing it on our YouTube channel. I'll share it on the Facebook page for listeners. And then also, if you guys are good with this, I'll get some further information from you to share resources in the show notes as well as on our social media. Because that's the next step, right? Is where do we go for tools?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great organizations out there and resources that we can provide.
Excellent. Felicia, Scott, thank you so much for being here. It's a really important issue. Thank you for addressing it. Thank you for a great presentation yesterday. And thank you for taking time out of what is now vacation sort of here in New Orleans.
We're still here
sort
for the conference.
But okay. Nah, get out there and have some fun.
Thanks. Glad to do it. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Friends, thank you. Friends, come on back to the NOLA Drink Show. We're here at the USBG Southern Regional Meeting. We'll talk with more people. Come on back.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in the podcast land wherever you are listening to the show. Thanks very much. I hope you found those interviews interesting, friends. I know in conducting them, I did two very important things. I guess one maybe a little bit more, I don't want to say fun, if you heard the seriousness of the Pisco interview and how it related to the political climate and culture and history of Peru, oftentimes not particularly pretty, and using Pisco as a vehicle to tell that story, I just found was fascinating. Stay tuned. When that documentary does get released for broader consumption, we will certainly let you know. It is really a wonderful work and well worth seeing. We'll give you that heads up. Hopefully that comes down the pike a little bit later on in the year on iTunes and maybe some other places, as we mentioned. Also, the part about sexual violence, of course, a very important issue in our society today, and of course in the bar and service hospitality spirits. Liquor industry is no exception. Perhaps in some ways it's even worse because of some of the unique dynamics that take place there. So I hope, again, you found that also very enlightening, another important interview. These two things are just, friends, I mentioned that we wanted you to hear these things because we think they're important. I think they relate to Tales of the Cocktail coming up next week, which we'll get into in just a second, issues that will be addressed, the Pisco as a product category and sexual violence as a threat in the industry, frankly. So we'll get there. I wanted to mention a couple things, an event coming up this weekend that I didn't mentioned at the top of the show, taking place Saturday from noon to 3 at Pontchartrain Vineyards. The winery is doing its quarterly wine club release party, and this is where wine club members get their quarterly release of wines, new wines. They're launching the new reserve wines, including a Grenache from the Livermore Valley of California. Really beautiful wine, by the way. And it's not just for wine club members. It's free and open for all to attend. There's live music from 12:30 to 3 from the wonderful singer-songwriter Lynn Drury. There is a food pairing that is only for wine club members, but you can find out more about that. It's just a lot of fun out there Saturday afternoon again from 12 to 3. Music is from 12:30 to 3. If you're interested, just go visit PontchartrainVineyards.com. Check that out. Excuse me. Friends, I wanted to mention a couple things too. As you know, I'm a big sports guy, even though we talk about the world of drink and food here on the NOLA Drink Show. I was watching the ESPYs last night, which is, of course, the ESPN sort of sports slash entertainment awards. Lots of nice moments in that show. I don't want to talk about this too much because that's not what this show is about, but a couple special shout outs. One of them was that Saints superfan Jarius Robertson was given the Jimmy V Award, which is, of course, the award for courage that honors the late great basketball coach Jim Valvano, who was a huge proponent of the battle against cancer. And this award is a courage award. They've established the Jimmy V Foundation years ago, raised a lot of money for it through ESPN, the ESPYs, these sorts of things, to provide funding for cancer research. And our young man here, Jarius Robertson, who's 15 years old, he suffers from a rare disease called biliary atresia. And he's a wonderful kid. And you've seen him almost certainly if you're here in the New Orleans area. He is certainly a Saints super fan. He's at all the games, does a lot of stuff. It was actually really cool. He was at the NBA All-Star game here in New Orleans a few weeks ago. His interview, sort of interview, if you will, Draymond Green of the Golden State Warriors on the sidelines was hilarious. We wish that man, young man, the best of luck. It was great to see him get the award. His speech was great because he gave a huge shout out to the Who Dat Nation and some things like that. Also, I want to make mention too of Craig Blackburn, who is a gentleman here also in Louisiana, and Craig is a Special Olympian. Part of the show last night was honoring the Icon Award, sort of a Lifetime Achievement Award, and in this case, posthumously to Eunice Kennedy Shriver, the woman who basically started the Special Olympics. And that was a very nice presentation given by former First Lady Michelle Obama, and brought up several Special Olympians with her. And Craig Blackburn was given a honorary ESPY, I believe, just, you know, for courage. I don't know specifically. I apologize for what the award was, but it was nice. He's from Louisiana as well. He has Down syndrome, but he has his own home. He's married. He is a bowling enthusiast. I believe that's what he competed in. And he also serves on the Athlete Leadership Council. And it's great to see a local Special Olympian be recognized. The presentation about the Special Olympics, friends, was great. And one of the things, Tim Shriver, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, son, gave, it was a bit of a long-winded speech, we'll be clear, but one of the things I like that he said in talking about special athletes in this case, that people that are different than us, acknowledging really that they have the power and should have the power to change things. And one of the things that he said that resonated with me is, don't close doors, I'm paraphrasing, don't close doors on people that are different than you. Welcome them. Don't be afraid. And I think we talk a lot about this in many ways. And again, this show is about drink and food, but there are issues that relate in the service industry. As some friends of ours who are from minority groups, gender issues, sexual orientation issues, these sorts of things. And even in this industry, which in New Orleans can be pretty liberal, there's still issues. In the broader culture of this industry, hospitality spirits industry, it's a big issue. So where I go with this is simply, I like what Tim Shriver had to say, is welcome people who are different than you, use it as an opportunity to learn, and embrace one another. Don't be afraid. Fear is so much of what the problem is here, right? There you go. So let's talk a little bit about Tales of the Cocktail, friends, coming up next week. As I mentioned, we're going to be all over it here on the NOLA Drink Show. We are going to be covering it left, right, top to bottom, well, as much as we can and as much as our livers here can take. We'll put it that way. It is the largest, I believe, they bill themselves as the world's premier cocktail festival, but it brings together thousands of people from the spirits industry, hospitality industry, bartenders, major focus there, that kind of thing. It's happened every year. This is the 15th annual one going on. The base of operations starts really in full tilt on a Tuesday and rolls through Sunday. The bulk of the seminars and tasting rooms and these things are really to a degree on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and there's some parties. There are, last year, I believe there were over 300 individual events. So yes, tasting rooms, seminars, blah, blah, blah. As I said, there's after hours parties, there's during hours parties, whatever that means, private tastings, media junkets, all kinds of stuff that go on left and right here at Tales of the Cocktail. There's just too much for one person to basically do. So you really do have to pick and choose your spots. You can still attend as a member of the public, how it works. I won't get into that. Just go to check out talesofthecocktail.com. You can find out basically how you can come and participate in some of the seminars and get a wristband to be in the tasting room. So things are pretty well booked up. So you need to kind of look to see what's available and check it out. Mostly takes place at the Hotel Monteleone on Royal Street. Little bits go on at the Royal Sonesta on Bourbon Street also. It's a large event. Last year, the estimate was that it generated, how much did it estimate that it generated? I'm sorry, here we go. 1.2 million. No, excuse me. 15.8 million in economic impact on the New Orleans economy, an additional 1.2 million in state and local tax revenue. Every year, the organization partners with the research department at University of New Orleans to generate an annual economic impact report. The estimate from 2008 through last year, 2016, that Tales of the Cocktail has generated a total impact of $101.2 million on local and regional economies. One of the things that gets noted here is that it comes in the third week of summer, as we've talked about on the show in various ways, the restaurant industry, some of this other stuff, we kind of slow down a little bit. And this is a nice shot in the arm for our tourist economy, which is really the major economy here in New Orleans. It's what we depend on. And so it's really nice to have this event. It brings a lot of luminaries in the cocktail world. It also brings a lot of newbies in the cocktail world. Okay. There's a lot of stuff that goes on that's kind of frat bro. And there people are always encouraged not to behave that way. But I think a lot of times you get people that come here and they actually learn what it's like to be a true professional in the industry. They learn from some of the best and brightest that we have to offer, of which we have many here in New Orleans who are actively involved in the event, and others that come from all over the world, that this is a professional trade event. And I think that that needs to be kept in mind. A little word to the wise, if you're coming for the first time or something like that, behave yourself, drink a lot of water, wear sunscreen. This is not all about how many cocktails or shots you can do in a day. Go to the seminars. They're interesting. Now, Tales of the Cocktail is one of those events, friends, that it's not without its controversy, and rightfully so. We're not going to talk about it too much today. There was an event recently with the founder, Ann Tunderman, and her husband being involved in basically a racist incident during Mardi Gras. There was a lot of backlash to that. I think we might even see some of that widely addressed, even if it's sort of non-officially at the event. I know some people were planning on not coming to the event out of protest, and I respect that. These are ongoing issues. One of the things that I'll say about Tales of the Cocktail, sort of a good thing and a bad thing, is that one, they may try and be a little bit more than what they should be, maybe just focusing on being a true trade event as opposed to trying to take on broader social issues. They are trying to take on sexual violence in the industry, why I played that interview earlier, which I applaud, but perhaps some of the people involved, like Proof Positive Project or Scott and Felicia Mayer, are maybe a little better equipped to do this. Sometimes I think Tales might try to be too much to too many people, and maybe should focus a little bit more on just being, as I said, a professional development event and organization and trade conference and organization. My two cents. But that being said, overall, on balance, as long as this education continues to move forward, as long as there continues to be engagement with everyone in the industry, that Tales does provide that forum, including the people who run Tales itself, then I'm okay with these things continuing and happening as they do. I believe that needs to remain open and transparent to a degree, how this all works. And again, maybe we'll probably talk further down the road after Tales is over a little bit about some of the things that might be, issues and areas of improvement or areas of focus that they maybe need to have. Hopefully that kind of makes some sense. We'll talk more about it, but it is important. It's good for the local economy. It's a good overall, it's a good event, bringing lots and lots of influential people, interesting people, talented people to our fair city. And we see a lot of interesting stuff, learn a lot of interesting things, and they learn a lot of interesting things from us. Friends, we're going to be covering it again. As I said, we're going to do the show next week live in the studio. We're going to have all kinds of different guests kind of coming in and out of the studio on Thursday from 3 to 5 p.m. here at the station. Should be pretty fun. And also, I'm going to be taping a whole bunch of stuff throughout the week. Some stuff being scheduled as we speak. Some stuff going to be on the fly. So a lot of these things over the coming weeks are going to roll out. All kinds of people, different brands, different products. products, different things are doing in the industry. I'm still working all this out. I'm just going to be carrying my mobile rig around and catching what I can catch. So stay tuned for a lot of great tales, the cocktail coverage. Check us out on social media at NOLA Drinks on Facebook, at NOLA Drinks on Instagram, at NOLA Drinks 1 on Twitter, because I'm going to be blasting stuff out all week long. Stay with NOLA Drinks here during Tales of the Cocktail. Friends, have a great week. Have a great weekend. Hopefully we'll see you at Tales of the Cocktail. Let us know if you are going to be there. And tune into the show next week and be on the lookout for more. Friends, until then, cheers, y'all.